I'm confused, Latimer. What's the point of coming to a giant's kitchen and not eating the giant cakes?
I'll just go and see if I can find a knife of appropriate proportions.
I'm sure the last time we had anything to do with giants, it ended badly.
Not to worry, Mum. This time round, I've already spoken to the giant, and he's very jolly and vegetarian.
Is that a giant jelly over there? It's bigger than my car. I just can't...
Mum? Mum? I strongly advise against climbing up there.
Whee!
Oh, dear.
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril.
Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't gone back in time and almost accidentally prevented your own birth in some kind of Freudian psychosexual nightmare. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. Please excuse the little bits of jelly in my hair. It's remarkably difficult to get out with just a clothes brush and a grumpy butler. I just couldn't resist bouncing on that jelly to the point where it lost its structural integrity. Oh well, at least we've seen that the giant has a sense of humour and isn't going to eat anyone. We've brought lots of cushions with us, as the top of this giant kitchen table is hardwood and not particularly comfortable to sit on. We've positioned our tea table as close to the centre of the table as we can, for safety reasons, but do look out for the edge if you go for a stroll.
I'm sorry to disturb you, ma'am, but your guest has arrived, a Mr. Cavan Scott.
Oh, splendid. Let's see his calling card. Ooh, a chocolate. How lovely. Thank you, Latimer. Now, what about that calling card?
That was his calling card, ma'am.
Oops.
Luckily, I committed it to memory before passing it over.
Oh, what did it say?
Nothing. It was blank. But on the other side, it said, Cavan Scott, author, comics writer, and maker-up of other stuff.
Marvellous. Send him in.
Very good, ma'am.
For those of you who don't know, Cavan Scott is an author and audio drama and comic writer for several series, including Doctor Who, Adventure Time, Judge Dredd, Blake 7, and Warhammer 40k. He also writes weekly strips for the Beano.
Mr. Cavan Scott, ma'am.
Hello, Cav. Do come and sit down. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, Emma, but we're very high up here.
Yes.
On this table. I'm not very good with heights, which is odd as I'm quite a tall chap, but you know, so as long as I don't look down, I think I'm going to be okay.
I'm not very good at heights either, which is why I've made sure that Latimer has set up our tea table right in the middle of the giant one.
Okay, and you can trust him on this. I mean, is he a trustworthy gentleman?
In matters of cake and tea, yes.
Okay.
And setting up little tiny tables in the middle of big tables, definitely yes.
Okay, I'll trust you on this then.
Yeah, we're fine. Yeah, we're fine with the table.
Marvellous.
Would you care for some tea?
Of course, I'd love some tea. What have you got?
Well, we have Assam in the pot. Would that be agreeable?
Assam's, that's lovely. Absolutely lovely.
Marvellous. And how do you take your tea?
With just a splash of milk, but only a little tiny bit.
Excellent. And would you like a slice of angel cake?
Oh, you are an angel, aren't you? Yes, I'd love one.
I will just cut you a slice here. And don't mind the chickens over there. You're not allergic to feathers or anything, are you?
No, no, I love a good chicken.
Good.
Actually, that sounds wrong, doesn't it?
It does. It does. Now, don't say that you'd love to eat one either.
Oh, no. Well, I do like eating chickens, but I've always wanted to keep chickens. But my wife has a bit of a bird thing. She doesn't like birds, so it's a little bit of a problem there.
Oh, it's quite common, actually, that, isn't it?
No, absolutely. So it's from years of working in Bath. And Bath, like London, is just full of pigeons that fly at you with no thought for anyone's safety, let alone their own. So I think years of that have sort of like trained her to sort of duck whenever she can hear wings going or whatever. So yeah, I did mention once having chickens, but I had the look.
The look of no.
Yes, exactly. And I gave up pretty quickly.
That's fair enough. I suppose it doesn't help with Bath that there's that bloke who wears that suit and has all the pigeons.
Yes,
on
exactly.
Him. Yeah.
We have some wonderful people of the streets in Bath. There used to be one called Happy Days, who just used to walk into pubs and go, Happy Days! and walk out again. And unfortunately, Happy Days, as he became known, passed away. And we were all quite sad. The city went into mourning. And then people just started carrying on the legacy by just walking into pubs and shouting Happy Days at each other. He became Bath.
Oh, wow. I love stories like that.
Yeah, he was great.
Now, in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring with you today?
I have bought my pet Cyberman head.
It certainly looks big enough to be a real one. Is that a real one?
It's from the moulds. It's not an actual one used in the show, but it was made from the moulds from the David Tennant Cybermen stories. So he's called Cyril. He sits in my study and looks at me. So if I have a moment when I'm not writing, I look up and I see the cold, unloving eyes of the Cyberman staring back at me, and I get a little bit scared and start writing again. So he's always watching me.
That sounds kind of scary, yeah. Okay, he doesn't actually say anything to you when you look at him, does he?
I can hear his voice in my head, Emma, but I think that's normal, isn't it?
Yes, good. Yes, good. Totally normal.
Excellent.
Now, I've been reading some conflicting advice on the internet lately.
Oh, okay.
There's no surprise there, but the conflicting advice I've been reading about is tidiness and clutter in a working space for creatives. And there are some people that say a tidy desk helps you to create because it gives you enough space to fill with your own creativity, I suppose. And there are others that say a chaotic desk is better for creative people because it inspires them and they can feel free to, you know, join things together and whatnot. I was wondering where you fall in this spectrum of your desk should be chaotic or tidy.
I like my desk to be tidy, and it starts tidy regularly. And then really, really quickly, it descends into absolute mayhem. And then I have to have weekends when I go, I'm going to tidy the study, and I disappear for 7 hours because it's just everything's just piled up around me. And when I say everything, I largely mean toys. The desk I left earlier to come here to the Giant's kitchen started today actually completely clear. But somehow, by the end of the day, there's a little bobblehead Groot appeared on it. I mean, I've generally got some Lego anyway of various forms. There's a Starship Enterprise which has fallen to bits. And this has all been while I'm working, while, you know, books and various different things that I've been working with. And I don't actually know how it happens, but it looks like a bomb's gone off now. And so, yeah, this generally happens. And it will get like this. It will get worse and worse and worse. Meanwhile, I will leave my study and yell at my daughters to tidy their rooms, because how can they live like it? And they'll look at me and go, have you seen your study? At which point I sort of nod and go, yes, good point. I like it to be tidy, but it never ends up that way.
Yes, yeah. I feel your pain. I'm very similar, actually. I was quite worried that when I was writing to a very, very strict deadline recently, that I got to the point where after writing all of the words that I needed to for that particular week, I found myself wanting to tidy up, and it was like a kind of mental clearing exercise. Or me turning into my mother. I'm not sure which. Both are kind of terrifying. I don't know. My mum is just so tidy, it's really, really weird, and I've never been like that at all. So I don't know. Maybe this just happened.
I always start a project with a tidy desk. So if I know something's starting, I juggle quite a lot of things. But if it's a big thing starting, I will make a point of tidying my desk the night before. So in the morning, I walk in and I'm surprised that I can walk to my desk. there is not sort of various just things just thrown across the floor and boxes that have spilled out or whatever. I usually set myself a word count or something for the day. I get to that point when I finish and I go, and I am done. I'm spent, and just leave the room as it was. And then return the next morning and go, oh, yes. So the coffee cup's starting to grow legs and walk away, you know, and things like that. So then I have a little time, but as the project goes on and I get near a deadline, there's no little bit of tidy in it. It's just like, just return to the chaos and then leave the chaos. That's the wonderful thing about having a workspace and a study, is that I can shut the door at it. I know it's there. I know the floor is probably sagging with stuff, but I don't have to think about it until the next morning when I open the door and go, oh no, I'm walking to the chaos.
Now, you mentioned that you juggle lots of different things, and it just seems like a crazy amount. From the outside looking in, you're doing so much all the time. There's always kind of new announcements, whether it's a Doctor Who comic or a Star Wars children's book for World Book Day, all kinds of amazing things.
Yeah.
And also magazines and comics and things like this. And something that I wondered about, particularly when you are juggling lots of different franchises that aren't your own worlds. How do you come up with so many different ideas for different properties under tight deadlines?
I came from a magazine background. I was a magazine journalist and editor, first of all. So I was used to spinning plates, especially when you get to editing. That's what you have to do. You're controlling so much. And then one of the magazines I was working on was Countryfile, and that's a huge magazine. Loads of things going on. So I was very used to multitasking. And I used to sort of pride myself that I could actually do this, and I could jump from one thing and change gears quite easily. And you know what? That was quite easy when I was dealing with a managerial role and dealing with sort of like nonfiction and things like that. When I started freelancing and writing fiction more often than not, I suddenly realized I couldn't do it so easily. And changing gears from one universe to another, whether it's my own stuff or whether I was writing for someone else's world, switching back and forth from children's fiction to adult fiction, which I do quite a lot as well, it was impossible. I used to hit walls. So what I have to do is get very boring and anal and start the month. We talked about tidying up. I have to start the month by working out what I'm doing that month and blocking out the large proportions of the day. And it used to be that I would think, oh, I'll do an hour on this and I'll move on to that. And it soon became obvious that I would spend too much time grinding the gears to try and work out what I'm doing. Yeah, I now block out a morning or an afternoon or sometimes the whole day. And so I know what day I'm hitting what universe. And that's in theory. It doesn't always work like that because, you know, things come in and they derail you. But that's the general idea. And I use music a lot, not when I'm writing, but it's almost like the palate cleanser to switch genres or switch types. Whether that's as easy as if I'm writing Doctor Who playing the appropriate Doctor's theme tune or just the kind of music that's not necessarily the property I'm writing for that precise moment, but of a type. So weirdly, when I write Blake 7, I play the music from Aliens, not the music from Blake 7. But it puts me in that sort of very grimy world where, you know, the future's not very nice, where people can't be trusted. And so it's things like that. And there's various soundtracks that I've got my favourite spooky soundtrack. I've got my favourite action soundtrack. Conan, the recent Conan film, wasn't so keen on the film, but the soundtrack is brilliant if you're writing fantasy with swords and like axes and rah monsters, because it's got that side kind of driving. And because I don't really associate it so much with the film itself, because I can't really remember that much about the film, it helps because it's sort of like a general feel to it. So yeah, never when I'm writing music, but a lot of the time to make me go, right, where am I? Let's put that on. And then my brain goes, oh, yeah, you're writing this again. And you sort of click in.
Yeah, it's amazing how powerful music can be.
Exactly, yeah. I can never, ever play it while I'm writing, even if it's just soundtrack, because I'll end up sitting listening to the music and going, oh, isn't this lovely?
I'm exactly the same. My very, very first trilogy that I wrote years and years ago, I could listen to music because it was based on a role-playing game that I GM'd, and it was the music I played during the game. And so there was a natural association, and I've been used to kind of tuning it out whilst GMing, so yeah. I could do that. Nothing else I've written, I don't know how many books I've written since, 6 books since then, couldn't listen to anything during any of them.
Yeah.
So I know exactly where you're coming from. But yeah, it's great for mood.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is. And because, I mean, that, I think that's the only way you can really switch projects is by, you know, putting yourself in it. Because, you know, I can go from writing Minnie the Minx for the Beano for 1 minute to writing, you know, a horror short story for myself. And so it actually, they're quite often very similar. But, you know, you do need that sort of like to go, right, where am I? What am I doing? Who's the audience? Okay, go.
So what's the best thing about playing in someone else's toy box?
Well, I've been quite lucky that the toy boxes I'm playing in at the minute are the toy boxes I grew up playing in when I was a child. And when I was a kid and I read comics, to be honest, I read comics more than I read books at first. It was later on that I got into reading books, because comics were my life, from your sort of Buster Beezer, nutty kind of comics right the way through to superheroes. And I was never someone who was just happy to just read them. I would draw with, you know, to a certain level, my own Minnie the Minx stories or my own Banana Man stories and things like that. And the same with Doctor Who and Star Wars and Blake Seven and Ghostbusters. You know, I'd be constantly making up. I mean, fan fiction without submitting it anywhere. You know, we didn't. And probably the first things I ever wrote for publication were Doctor Who fan fiction for fanzines. So I've been working in these other sandpits all my life. So then when I get the chance to do it professionally, someone will pay me to sit there and do exactly what I did when I was a kid. Yeah, go on then. You know? So, I mean, there's always, I know, because you had James Goss in the Lair recently, didn't you? And I know, James, and we've talked about this before, there are limitations when you're writing someone else's world because there are rules set up. But that also means there's a wonderful shorthand that's already there. And while you never want to just repeat what's gone on before, you want to bring something new to it, you can get straight to that without having to do all the background work to build the world. Because hopefully, especially if you're writing for fans, they'll know the world backwards and probably better than you anyway. So there's a certain shorthand you know is going to be there, especially with Doctor Who. They know everything. And so then the fun is that you make them think you're going down one route and then you twist at the last minute and go, ha-ha, I have changed everything. You hate me now.
And twiddle your moustache.
Yeah, exactly. Which I have to grow specifically for Doctor Who, which is hard. I don't really grow a good moustache. I know this is hard to believe, but it's true. I've never grown a good moustache. So I put on a fake moustache. This is quite bizarre now. Then I twiddle that. It's playing with people's expectations. In the same way, I suppose, if you're writing something of your own that you've worked on for a long time, you've got that background. So you're just sort of getting straight to it. But again, it's all part of that sort of spinning plates. And why I think I'm so fortunate in doing what I do is that I can play in someone else's world and then go off and do some of my own world and then go back to playing in their world again. So, and doing so many different genres means that it doesn't get boring. It means that I naturally have to keep it fresh because I'm moving somewhere else, if you know what I mean. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It totally makes sense. Now, I have this theory that everyone in their career is either heading towards or has fond memories of a particular moment where they think, I've made it, yes. Has that happened for you yet?
It happened last week.
Oh.
Because, as I said, I'm a massive comics fan, and I was asked to provide a cover blurb for a Vertigo comic for Red Thorn. And I've recently written some things for Vertigo, which in itself has been amazing. You know, when the check arrived with DC's logo on it. Right, it's not the logo I remember from a kid, but it's still a DC Comics logo on a check. I didn't want to cash it because I did cash it because it was money. But, you know, I did want to because I was going, that's amazing. So that was great. But then, being asked to have a cover quote on someone else's comic and a Vertigo comic as well, you know, that was amazing. It was one of those moments when I had a complete panic, first of all. I was like, well, God, why, what am I going to say about it? You know, why are people going to care? But then actually seeing it on the front of the book, it was amazing. And it's just one of those silly moments. And I actually said to someone, you know, I know this is a really silly thing to get excited about. And they went, no, it isn't, because this is a moment when people are asking for your advice about what you like. And yeah, so that was great. That was definitely one of those moments.
Yay.
And it's Red Thorn, if anyone wants to read it. It's brilliant. It's set in Scotland, and it's all about Scottish demigods. We're very sexy and don't wear very many clothes because it's Vertigo.
Marvellous.
Well, I hate Thorn himself because he's got perfect abs and butt. It's amazing. It's a great bit of world building. It's fantastic.
Cool. Now, would you rather have to always tell the truth, or would you rather never be able to tell the truth? And if you could answer that truthfully, that would be awesome.
How do you know I'm going to? Well, it'd be quite challenging, wouldn't it? If you had to, you'd have to be really creative if you could only tell the truth, because there'll be those moments when you know you really shouldn't tell the truth, when it would really be hurtful to other people. It'd be quite liberating just to say, I'm sorry, I can't lie, you're rubbish. I quite like it if people just knew that would be the case, because it means that, you'd have to be completely open and no one could. Because I hate politics and I hate playing games and I hate all that nonsense. It's one of the reasons I went freelance and I didn't want to edit magazines anymore, because of all the faff you have going on behind the scenes and you've got power games and all that kind of thing. And there's so many lies told in the working environment all the time, in any work environment, not just in media. And so it'd been great to force everyone and force myself to tell the truth there, because you find yourself doing it as well. You sit in a meeting and you're not saying what you think, because you know that would be detrimental for everyone's career, mostly your own. I think say the truth and then damn the consequences. That would be amazing if you could escape everything for doing that.
Yeah, and it would. I guess it would be also interesting that you would get a reputation for being the one who always tells the truth, so you may actually end up being kind of well-respected.
Or dead.
Or dead, yeah.
Or killed horribly.
But nowhere in between, one
especially
or the other.
Especially if you had lots of secrets that you weren't supposed to tell anyone.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you're blighted with only being able to tell the truth. The people who gave you the secrets would be quite miffed about this.
Yeah, they would.
Yeah.
There's a comic in this.
I'm telling you, I'm writing notes now while balancing my tea on my knee.
So whenever I have a friend in the tea lair, I like to ask on the Twitters if anyone has any questions
yes.
that they would ask if they were able to take tea. Mm-hmm. I've had three really good ones, actually. There were more, but these are my three favourite ones. Okay. So the first is from Gav Reeds, and he wanted to know if you use your Beano writing to be as naughty as you can because you're such an angel in real life.
Is that why you gave me angel cake?
Yes.
I am obviously such an angel who never tells lies. Yeah, it is one of those great things. In the Beano, you can get the characters doing all kinds of things that you'd never be allowed to do in polite company. All the things I tell my girls not to do, Minnie and the Bash Street Kids and Dennis will get up to. So it is a wonderful release in that. I do obviously mine my daughters and their friends for ideas regularly, you know, because I do, you know, two or three strips a week for the Beano. So you get to the point when you're going, how can they be naughty now?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying my daughters are naughty. They are obviously also angels because they get it from me. But they say something and I go, oh, just imagine if that got slightly worse. And it sort of spins from there. So yeah, it is great. You know, to write naughty characters is actually quite rare in children's fiction. To actually be able to allow to let children really thumb their nose to adults. Because usually you do get a lot of people saying, well, they can't really be that naughty. But in the Beano, no, that's what they are. So it is quite nice.
But when you're writing these strips, do you ever have at the back of your mind, I'd better make sure that this isn't the kind of thing that if a kid did it, they'd kill somebody? Or...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it has to go so over the top that it obviously could never happen. And it's, you know, we've changed a lot in the Beano. We don't have Dennis menacing Walter for being a softy now, because that's bullying for various, because he likes flowers and girly things, which you can't really do these days. So now Walter is evil. I love him. He wants to be prime minister one day and he wants to cancel fun. So now there's a reason for Dennis to want to foil him at every turn. So, but yeah, definitely. And when I was writing Roger the Dodger, I was very aware that kids might try and get out of stuff by copying Roger. So you just make it go. It's obvious as well, especially with something like Roger. He's putting far more effort into getting out of the work than the work would have taken in the first place.
Yeah.
So and kids know that. That's the joke. They know that he's they might as well just do the washing up. Rather than go and steal an elephant from the zoo so then you can wash it with its trunk and break all the plates so you never get asked to do it. I mean, that's a lot of effort. You can't usually get elephants, I found. I did a bit of research. They wouldn't let them out of the zoo doors. So, you know, it's so bizarre. It would never happen, hopefully. This is where I find out that there's been a zoo that's missing an elephant now and they're going to blame me again.
So another question came from George Mann, and he would like to know if there are any established comic characters that you'd love to write for that you haven't written for yet.
Oh, well, I am a bit of a superhero nut. Superman's there. I mean, I'd love to write Superman. Wonder Woman, like, more than anything. I'd love to write Wonder Woman. I think Wonder Woman's amazing. And what's been happening with her recently is really interesting as well. Over on the Marvel side of the fence, Thor... So I'm a complete and utter Viking geek and nerd, which is how I got a job working with Titan on the Vikings comic, because I went to the Jorvik Viking Centre when I was a kid in York.
Yes.
And just fell in love with it and joined the Viking club. Oh, there was a club. They sent you letters and badges and things. And I was a complete and utter Viking geek as a kid, and I still am to this day. So yeah, Thor would be amazing.
So the last question is from a very old friend of mine, Dom, as in we've been friends for a very long time.
Not that he's ancient.
No.
He's 87, is Dom. He's hanging on in there. He lives in a home and he smells of weed.
He doesn't. Dom is lovely.
Okay, sorry.
And he's just been my friend for many years. Right. And he would like to know, if you had a chance to write for the Doctor Who TV series, which direction would you like to take it in?
Ooh. Oh, that's an interesting question, isn't it?
Mm.
So now you're going to want an interesting answer, aren't you?
Well, if it's not too much trouble.
Okay, I'll have a go. You know, my ideal Doctor Who is perhaps not that dark, but still scary. I like Doctor Who to be, quote, a family show, that the family sit down together. I mean, I loved it when it came back. And I don't call it New Who and Old Who and Classic Who. It's all Doctor Who, as far as I'm concerned. So when it came back in the 21st century, I love the fact that it became a family show, that entire families would sit down and sort of reinvented that family TV slot that meant we got things like Robin Hood and Merlin, you know, and things like that. So I'd want it to be that kind of show. I say, not scary without being so dark that parents would be worried about their kids watching it. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes you've got to be careful, you know, showing your kids Doctor Who, but I'd want it to be that, you know, there wouldn't be that thing of the parents wincing and, you know, going, oh, should we have done this? Not too much continuity. When you write a lot of stuff for fans, like and comics and audios and books, continuity comes into part of that because that's what people want out of those kind of stories, because they're buying into it, because they want to have the thrill of sort of, you know, continuity and references they can pull out. And I always try to make sure the references I put in there don't get in the way of the story, but they're little sort of nods and winks for people who know. Again, a little bit of continuity every season, but pushing new stories, new monsters, new creatures, new planets to go to. Yes, family, fun, adventures, not too dark. Oh, and also I like my TARDIS, I like TARDIS crews, so I like more than two people in the TARDIS. I like the dynamics of, which of course was how Doctor Who started, of it being a family that are thrown together and perhaps don't necessarily get on. That means that the Doctor himself can sort of become a little bit more mysterious and more childlike, usually, because you've got the human companions who are there to sort of pull him back onto the straight and narrow.
Excellent.
That's my Doctor Who. So when, you know, Chris Chibnall passes on for the role that he hasn't started yet, I'll be waiting, BBC.
Good grief, that's the thing, isn't it? When you've got people already saying, well, when you're done,
I know.
Before you even started.
What
an interesting job, yeah.
It's like when you visit someone and they say, well, when are you going? You know, it's so yeah, it's that. But I love the changes in Doctor Who. It's a show that is made to change. And stuff like now, where you've got the showrunner leaving and a new showrunner coming in, all the fans are now all sort of talking about what's it going to be like, you know, guessing, obviously, when we get new Doctors as well. I love all that because it's that real unknowns world that you go into. It's still going to be Doctor Who. It's still going to be recognisable, but everything's going to change. And I find that really exciting.
And something that fascinates me with, I have an 8-year-old boy who is just so, so deeply in love with Doctor Who. And what fascinates me every time a new Doctor comes up, and I think he's only been through, I don't know, two or three since he started watching it, like regularly, is how he falls in love with the new one. And I always think, oh, is this going to be the one that he doesn't like so much?
Yeah.
And he has his favourites and he's watched like all of the other Doctor Whos that he could ever find.
Yeah.
And, you know, so he's seen all of them and he definitely has favourites. But I love the way that for each one, there is something about him that he loves.
It's still the Doctor.
Lovely.
At the end of the day. You know, no matter, we all have different personalities depending on who we're with. You know, we're the same people, but you have different faces. And that's how I've always viewed the Doctor, is that we're seeing a facet of his personality that doesn't mean the rest aren't there. It's just this is the one that's coming out at the minute.
Yeah, that's an interesting take. I will discuss that with him when we next walk to school together.
Marvellous.
Something I like to ask all of my friends who come into the tea there is, if you could have a theme tune for your life, what would it be?
It would have to be Don't Stop Me Now by Queen, which is my favourite song ever in the world. One, I am determined that it will be a song played at my funeral, because I think that's just a good song to go out on, because it makes people happy.
It's so wonderful.
Yeah, it makes people smile, you know, and, you know, I don't like stopping. I'm not very good at sitting down and relaxing, and I'm constantly being told off about this because I do live what I do quite a lot, and a lot of what I do is involved in my hobbies and things like that. But I do find it quite hard to stop and slow down, which is not always a good thing, but at the same time, I don't think I'd have it any other way.
Oh, I hear you. Excellent. So the reason I ask is because the little chickens over there are quite special chickens. Well, they're very special chickens, and they can actually sing. Yes.
It's the bow ties.
I didn't think you would notice.
I always notice a chicken with bow ties.
Well, I thought, well, if we tuck them under the feathers, no one will notice. But you've got a sharp eye, Kev.
I have.
You have. So, little chickens, could you sing Don't Stop Me Now by Queen for Cav, please? There they go.
Oh, that's wonderful. And there is one doing a Freddie Mercury impression. You can't see this at home, but he's got a microphone and everything and a little jacket. And that's you know, that's really committing. I like that.
Yeah, well, they're growing in confidence, Excellent. Shall we say.
So are they going on tour soon? Or is this something you're going to be looking at?
Well, you know, quite a few people have asked us this, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure. It's, you know, it's an important decision to make, isn't it, going on tour?
Well, you know, you look what happened to Shawaddy Waddy. Look what it did to them. Dreadful.
They'll start asking for like particular colours of corn in bowls in their changing rooms.
And, exactly, and different combs.
Yeah, it would be very difficult, so maybe not. So is there anything that you've got coming up soon or coming out that you're particularly excited about?
Well, yeah, from the kids' side of things, I'm part of World Book Day this year.
Mm.
So there's 10 authors in the UK, in England, there's actually 11 if you include Ireland as well, who will bring out these little sampler books that kids get vouchers for at school and they can swap it for a book. And I've written one of those 10, which is the beginning of a new Star Wars series.
Whee.
Set in the Star Wars universe, a new part of the universe we've not seen before. It's going to be great because I mean it's a big event in a couple of weeks' time in the beginning of March. And it's very exciting, you know, to be able to out there. I'll be going on tour. I'm doing a show with Julian Clary. The day after World Book Day, and Steve Cole and various other people as well, which is going to be very exciting as we all talk about why we read and why we love books.
Oh my God, Julian Clary!
I know. I'm going to, if Fanny the Wonder Dog isn't there, I'm going to be very upset. I know.
Oh my God, I'm so jealous because I have loved Julian Clary for so long, and I'm fairly certain that he did the most amazing minute on Just a Minute about his shed.
Oh, which I think he did. Yes, I know the one. Yeah.
It was just the pinnacle for me of Just a Minute. It was just the most beautiful thing.
I'm hoping I'm not going on after him because we all get a little slot in the show and we get sort of loads of school kids come in and we all get like 15 minutes to do something. And I'm praying I'm not after Julian Clary because I think that's going to be the worst possible slot.
Yeah.
So I'll be his warm-up man. I'll be happy with that. I'll go on, be a little bit funny, and whip them up a little bit, and then he'll come on and be wonderful and fabulous. So I'll be happy with that. If I'm on after him, I might cry a bit. Not on stage.
Oh, wow. That is really exciting.
It is really exciting. And, you know, when people ask me, why do you write time fiction, especially for children? It's because I know that when I was a kid, some of the only books I ever read were tie-in books, mainly Terence Dicks. You know, but they really got me excited and got me reading. And I do a lot of work in schools, working with kids who won't read, but they'll read a book based on their favourite video game. And I did a lot of work with Skylanders in the past when it first came out. They'll read a book based on a TV show or a toy or a film. And you know that once you've got them, you've got them. And they'll understand that books can be for them. And yes. I think that's half the problem. They don't understand that books can be for them. So to have one of the books being a Star Wars book, for people who might go, oh, books, really? I'd rather be hit over the head by a brick. If they love Star Wars, hopefully they'll pick that up and then realise, well, there's more out there.
That's fantastic. Well, I hope it all goes brilliantly well. Now, let me just check the tea. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty.
Oh, I was enjoying that. That was a really nice brew as well.
Yes, it was, wasn't it? But never mind. I'm sure we'll be able to do this again another time. And undoubtedly, I will see you again soon.
I hope so.
All that's left for me to say is thank you so much for joining me in the tea lair today.
No, thank you, and the chicken.
Follow Latimer, and he will show you the best way to get down from this very, very scary high table.
You know, he's not just going to push me, is he?
No, he's not going to push you. He's not going to push you. It'll be fine.
Okay, then, bye.
Bye-bye, take care. Bye.
This way, sir.
Oh, I didn't realise the giant was going to carry Cav out on the tray. How kind.
Yes, ma'am. Straight into the oven.
What?
Oh, wait, no, wait. No, don't shut the door.
I thought you said he was a vegetarian.
He is, ma'am, but he makes an exception for fish and comics writers.
Ho, 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 I eat comic book writers.
Cav's doing something inside the oven. He's waving his arms.
People in a hot oven have been known to do that, ma'am.
His chicken song choice is so much more poignant now. He doesn't look panicked so much as if he's doing magic.
The two often appear remarkably similar, ma'am. No, wait. I do believe you're correct. Observe the tray of gingerbread men over there.
Gingerbread men?
As I suspected. He's a secret gingermancer. I thought they'd all died out.
The gingerbread men are moving. It's like some kind of doughy zombie horror. Well, if enough of them manage to get onto the handle of the oven door, they might be able to get it open. Oh, they did it!
I do hope the gingerbread men are vegetarian.
Well, they seem to be, but Cav's just taken a bite from one of their heads.
How rude!
But very understandable, given how tasty they look. Well, now that we know that Cav's going to be okay, do you think this is a good time to mention that my novel Planetfall is eligible for awards this year?
No, ma'am. One does not simply announce one's award eligibility, especially at afternoon tea.
Oh, well, I suppose that means I can't mention that Pete's book, The Vagrant, is also eligible this year.
I refer you to my earlier statement, ma'am, most forcefully.
Well, it's always a good time to appreciate our splendid Order of the Sacred Teacup, full of lovely people with fine taste. Should you wish to join the esteemed order and find out how Latimer became my butler, go to www.patreon.com/TeaAndJeopardy.
You're not promoting again, are you, ma'am?
Oh, no, no, not at all. Why don't you make a nice cup of tea before we go?
Very good, ma'am.
And Tea and Jeopardy is also eligible for a Hugo Award for the best fan cast.
Did you say something, ma'am?
No.
I'm sure I sense some promotion going on.
No, no, not at all. Now, do get the tea, Latimer. And have a think about the next tea there, would you? Somewhere a little less high up.
Very good, ma'am.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes, and www.patreon.com/TeaAndJeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.